Earth's sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. We have science interviews this week on meteor showers to look for, and a five-time astronaut speaks on the end of the space shuttle era. Here's a scientist soundbite.
It was a great launch, and just wonderful to see the shuttle Atlantis launch and be there on the ground. I loved being on board, but it was just as spectacular watching it from the ground.
You're listening to Dr. Bonnie Dunbar, a materials scientist and NASA astronaut who has flown five missions on the space shuttles, once on Challenger, twice on Columbia, once on Endeavour, and one historic mission on Atlantis, STS-71, which in 1995 was the first time a spacecraft docked with a space station, the Russian space station Mir. Dr. Dunbar is on the line now to talk about the era of the space shuttles, which began in 1981 with the launch of Columbia and ended with the last shuttle flight ever of Atlantis in July of 2011. Dr. Dunbar, welcome.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
What are your thoughts on the final flight of Space Shuttle Atlantis and of NASA's shuttle program?
Well, I'm very proud of that program, having been associated with the original development of it in the 1960s and then 30 years of flight experience, having flown five flights myself, and having been an engineer on the shuttle for Rockwell when we built it in the 70s. I have to tell you, it's an amazing vehicle. It hasn't been replicated yet, and I'm sorry to see it stop flying.
So maybe you could tell us about some of the highlights of the shuttle Atlantis. This is the last shuttle that is launched by NASA. This flight is the very last one of the shuttle program. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about one of the highlights to start off with, perhaps. And that was of the historic first link up in space back in 1995 of a space station, the Russian Mir, and the space shuttle Atlantis. Dr. Dunbar, what was it like to be an astronaut at that historic event?
Well, that was pretty exciting. For me, it actually started back in 1994 when I was assigned as a backup. So I traveled to Russia. I trained as a backup for 13 months. And then when I was brought back, I then integrated into the shuttle crew. We had a space lab in the payload bay, and I'd flown two prior space lab flights. And we trained for 3 months prior to the docking. One of the objectives was to, once we docked, then that space lab became a medical research laboratory, and we performed a number of experiments on the shuttle crew or the station crew, including norms. So I immediately came back from Russia, started training with the shuttle crew. Hoot Gibson was the commander. We then launched, and of course, docking with the Mir was just quite amazing. And part of my job was, since I spoke Russian at that time, was communicating to the Russian crew on board. And then we had also brought up my backup crew, Anatoly Soloviev and Nikolai Budarin. So it was quite exciting.
Yeah, that's really what Atlantis, what the space shuttle Atlantis is perhaps known for, is for building these international collaborations on the space station Mir, and also helping to build the International Space Station. The space shuttle Atlantis also launched some important scientific instruments into space, telescopes. As a scientist, what would you say is the most significant contribution to science made by space shuttle Atlantis?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd have to go back through the manifest, and I'd say the scientist and engineer, because I am an engineer and I'm having built the shuttle, is that just the accomplishment of what we did, put a lifting body into space, launch it like a rocket, land it like an airplane, be able to take 50,000 pounds, not just to Earth orbit, but bring it back, and sustain up to eight people. There were eight crew members on my first flight. That's engineering achievement. No one has achieved that to date, and I think it'll be a long time before they replicate it. So we shouldn't diminish that. Just the building and successful operating of the shuttle has advanced us decades in learning how to live and operate in space. Then in addition to that, it's a platform, and it's a cargo truck, all those things. So taking objects to orbit, bringing them back, carrying space labs in them, so that we can do research in microgravity environments, both biomedical as well as material science and so forth. Those are small stepping stones. They may get buried in the press, but unless we do that, we're not going to continue to explore. And that's really important to remember. If you go back to the Apollo flights, people remember the moon landings. They don't remember all the Mercury, Gemini, and pre-Apollo flights in Earth orbit just to learn how to do that, how to dock, for example, how to do spacewalks on a routine basis, how to build life support systems. You need all of that core technology before you can really explore.
May I ask you once again to look back at the shuttle program? In many ways, the past 30 years of human spaceflight have marked the era of the shuttle program, with the beginnings with the Enterprise, Columbia, Challenger, the Discovery, Endeavour, and finally with Atlantis. You've flown 5 missions on 4 different shuttles. What do you remember most about the shuttle era?
Well, gee, that's a hard one to answer. I was just very fortunate to be part of some of the initial R&D while I was an undergraduate at the University of Washington in Seattle. And this was in the 60s when NASA was already working with the universities on selection of materials for the thermal protection system. Then I was very fortunate in the 70s to go to work for Rockwell, helping to build Columbia, and then to be selected as an actually, as a flight controller at NASA in 78, and as a payload officer, and then in 80 as an astronaut, and then flying the 5 flights. So I've had an opportunity to look at a lot the engineering, the operations, and the flight part of working on the shuttle. And it's such a complex but beautiful vehicle that has worked so well. We're on our 135th flight. Who would have known? People look back at history and say, well, maybe it should have been 150, and that's not the point. The point, this is hard to do. The Soviet Union tried to do it with Buran, and they weren't able to. We should be proud of what the engineering community was able to achieve and know that it's going to be a platform for the future. They will come back and look at the shuttle.
In July of 2011, Space Shuttle Atlantis launched for its final flight. And basically the final flight of the shuttle program, and I understand you were there at the launch. I'd like to get a sense of the emotion there. What did it feel like? And is it sad? Are you sad? Are you happy about the future? What are your feelings about the end of the shuttle era?
Well, I guess I'm not a big one on being able to articulate what feelings were. There were quite a few astronauts there. We gathered together in Orlando and then took buses out to the launch site. Great deal of pride. You can't help but feel pride in that, as the countdown proceeds to zero, the entire crowd gets up and sings the national anthem with their hands on their heart. There's a great amount of public pride in this, and I was told there were 1 million people there. So to be part of this national movement that is in its 6th decade, I think is just wonderful. And then as we discussed, there is some, sadness there because we're not really sure what comes next. This is the first time in, 50 years where we're actually completing one program, terminating it, without having really let the contract to build another program and project.
Right. I mean, do you have anything to tell people who feel not that now there's something missing, now that this source of hope and of dreams of discovering something new outside of Earth, it's gone now? You just mentioned that there's going to be a gap before anything like it returns, perhaps. What would you like to tell somebody looking forward?
I think a couple of things. First of all, I've heard the comment, well, why doesn't NASA do this and NASA do that? And I think this is a civics lesson. NASA works through the president, and it implements programs decided by the nation. It doesn't decide on its own. It can propose science. It can propose destinations. But the funding for that, the final decision, comes through a collaboration between Congress and the administration. What we do is very dependent upon what the American public wants to do. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. So if the American public wants this nation to continue to lead in space or be one of the leaders and to innovate and pump resources into new technologies and new knowledge, they have to articulate that. And I think the other part of the discussion I hear and probably needs to be clarified is that there's a misconception on how much of our resources go into space. When we were going to the moon, we peaked at about 4.4% of our federal budget. And out of that, we got satellites, weather, communication, computers, new materials, new medical technologies. It's ad infinitum, and I think the studies show about a 10-to-1 on return of an investment. The present cost of our human spaceflight program is less than 0.5%. This nation spends more on cosmetics and, I think, potato chips and pizza than it does on investments in technology and exploration. So that says something about a nation that would choose that way. And we don't choose wisely, we will live with what the results are. And I think it's really important to have an open debate about what we want to be in the 21st century as a nation. My hope is that we continue to lead. Great nations explore. In the process of exploration, they acquire new knowledge and they generate new technologies that go into their well-being and their standard of living. And if we pull back now, I think that we should look at the lessons of history. We may not be happy with the result. This one vehicle, in its 30 years of flight, has built up, you know, hundreds of companies that have then spun off into other parts of our economic well-being and new technology. So, it's hard for me when I hear, well, what did it do for me? It's done everything, and I hope that somehow we can find ways to communicate that to the American public.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about NASA's Space Shuttle program?
I want them to pay tribute to the great engineers both in NASA and with the contractors, by the way. This is a real team effort across the nation, to really thank them for what they did back in the 60s and the 70s when they built this amazing vehicle that, by the way, has taken twice as many astronauts into space as any other country has and has flown international astronauts, gave us the Hubble Space Telescope, helped to assemble a space station, and has probably given thousands of graduate students their dissertations based on the research that was done and published papers. So I personally thank all of them, and I hope the American public will as well.
Dr. Dunbar, thank you for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to astronaut Bonnie Dunbar, president and CEO of her own consulting firm, Dunbar International LLC. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird is here now to talk about the global night sky and meteor showers in July and August. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. This time of year, which is summer in the Northern Hemisphere, is typically the very best time of year to watch for meteors. And there are two major showers that are converging around now, the Delta Aquarid shower and the very famous Perseid meteor shower. The Delta Aquarids are sometimes said to peak at the end of July, and on paper they do peak at the end of July, but in fact the Delta Aquarids have a very long, rambling peak that lasts for a number of weeks. So by the time the Perseids peak, which is typically around the mornings of August 11th, 12th, 13th, the Delta Aquarids are still going, and you'll see Perseid meteors flying from the Perseid meteor shower radiant point, and you'll see Delta Aquarid meteors flying up from the other direction.
So, Deborah, will this year be a good year to see meteors?
Well, you might read that it's not a good year, and the reason is the moon. This year, the moon is waxing toward full in the early part of August, and that means that by August 11th, 12th, 13th, there will be an extremely full-looking moon in the sky for most of the night, and it'll drown out many of the meteors. But there will be an opportunity to watch meteors in 2011. So again, the Delta Aquarids are peaking in late July. So late July, after midnight, you might see meteors flying. And as August begins and you have an opportunity to get out in the country and get up early in the morning and look at the sky, say in the hour or two before dawn, you might see meteors then as well. If you're specifically interested in watching the Perseid meteor shower, which many people are, we get many, many emails from people every year saying, when is the best morning to watch the Perseids? This year, we're saying that the best morning to watch the Perseids is not on the morning of the peak, which is around August 11th, 12th, 13th, but actually the morning before that, August 10th. So between the hours of 3 a.m. and dawn on August 10th, the moon will be setting around 3 a.m. and dawn won't have broken yet, and yet we're very close to the Perseids' peak time. So that day, the morning of August 10th, should be a good day to watch for Perseid meteors.
Yeah, this is a great time to see meteors, July and August. And we've gotten responses on Facebook at Earth Sky on people seeing meteors all throughout the year.
That's true. There are about a dozen major meteor showers every year, and those are better or worse basically depending on the whereabouts of the moon, mostly. But all throughout the year, really nearly every night, you have an opportunity to see meteors. And it's been pretty interesting on Facebook because, you know, in the past few years since we've had a Facebook page, we'll notice that a week will occur when suddenly everybody is saying, I'm seeing meteors, I'm seeing meteors. And these are the minor meteor showers that don't get much publicity, but, you know, they do occur. So on any night of the year, if you're in a dark place, look up and you might see a meteor.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Boxing Lesson, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't end it terrifying. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't. The art of the next stage. We'll be right back.
but we know what you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you won't know, but you won't know, but you won't know what you don't know.